Find the perfect space for your business with DRK & Company Realty. Flexible office suites are available. Employees and clients benefit from free parking, front door access, and walkable dining, retail, and hotels at the Polaris Lifestyle Center. Managed by DRK & Company Realty, one of Central Ohio's most trusted leaders, this safe, well-maintained property offers dedicated on-site management and responsive maintenance. Grow your business at an address designed for success at 470 Old Worthington Road. Visit drk-realty.com to learn more.
Thanks for downloading the Charlie Higson and Friends podcast, which originally broadcast on Scala Radio, a station where we have fun with classical music. It's home to Penny Smith, Simon Mayo, Mark Kermode, and me, Charles Nove. And you can find us on DAB Digital Radio, scalaradio.co.uk, and on the Scala app. Right, over to you, Charlie.
Hello, I'm Charlie Higson, and welcome to another edition of Charlie Higson and Friends. My friend today is an actress, writer, and comedian. I'm delighted to welcome Lucy Porter. Hello, Lucy.
I'm delighted to be welcomed. Thank you for having me.
Well, I feel a little bit presumptuous describing you as a friend, in as much as we only met for the first time in 2022. And we met... It was a weird one, wasn't it?
What a night it was. I mean, I think we covered a lot.
Yes. Well, for those who weren't there, I'll explain what it was. It was a comics festival in the Lake District. And by comics, I don't mean the sort of people who stand on stage and make people laugh for a living, which is partly what you do.
Mm-hmm.
It is the sort of comics that you draw.
Yes.
And we were involved in a light-hearted quiz about comics. I'm really into comics, and I've written a couple. I did write a couple of things for Viz in the early days. Were you there as a comics fan or
no? I mean, I'll be honest. It was a gig. I was just there because I love the Lake District, and I do. I mean, I love comics, and especially Viz actually, because that's huge in our house. Because my husband has every edition of Viz ever, and our children pick up Viz now and they're like, oh, can we read this funny comic? And I'm like, just maybe a couple of years, because they're only 10 and 12. But I loved that festival so much. It's a yearly event, actually, if the listeners want to go.
Yeah, it's a fantastic festival, very well looked after, and it's in that slightly sort of surreal setting of being in the Lake District, which is not what you associate with kind of smash, pow, kapow.
Yes, I know, but it was lovely seeing, because there's all these slightly, like, everybody's got pink hair and they're all sort of very cool and American, and people come from all over the world to do this festival. And it was really nice seeing the Lake District with all these kind of slightly alternative, weird hipsters. And they're also talented as well. That's the thing is, you know, comics who stand on stage, I kind of get how that's done, but comics...
So, I mean, but if someone asks you what you do, do you describe yourself as a comic?
No, I say I'm a florist. Because I hate that thing.
Cut off the conversation.
Yeah. Oh, tell us a joke. Oh, who's the most famous person you met? Or, you know, do you know Michael McIntyre? So, yeah, I tend to lie about what I do. But if pressed, then I would probably... Oh, God. Yeah, I'd say stand-up, really, because that's the only thing that's stuck. I've tried different things, but stand-up's the only one that I keep coming back to.
And so, Lucy, do you know Michael McIntyre?
But I can tell you a joke.
No, but we
what
and we
do
found
you call
out
a magic dog a labracadabrador. There you go. That's
very
a nice
festive
joke. Yeah.
But so we got to chatting as you do at these events, and we found out we had a huge amount in common. So I was, you know, in making this series, I thought it would be great to have Lucy on and talk to you a little bit more.
Yes, well, because we explored many things that night. Quizzing was
yes,
yeah,
so we'll come on to that.
Them.
We had many things in common, and in fact, our careers have sort of overlapped in certain ways over the years without us actually probably meeting each other before. So I'm very much looking forward to joining the dots today, which I will be doing while you're talking. I've got one of those little puzzle books. But as this is a music programme, let's start with a piece of music. And what I always ask my guest stroke friend is, what was the first piece of music you heard where you were kind of aware that there was music other than pop music?
Yeah, because I had my older sister is 10 years older than me, and so she, from a very young age, was feeding me like the Boomtown Rats and sort of New Romantic stuff. So that's what I thought music was. But my dad was a huge classical music fan, and I suppose the first thing I remember is. Your tiny hand is frozen, let me warm it into life, was something that he used to say to me. And then he'd sing this weird song and I kind of didn't really understand what was going on. And then eventually he played me the piece of music and I was like, oh my goodness, this is, you know, do I like this? I'm not sure, but it's not like anything else I've ever heard.
Did he listen to a lot of classical music?
He did. So my dad was born in Belfast in the 30s and he was in a Catholic family, but his dad was an RUC officer, which was sort of very rare even then. And so he had this incredibly... quite traumatic upbringing, actually. So they moved around a lot, but he spent a lot of time at this school run by the Christian Brothers, Christian in name only, really, because they beat the absolute living daylights out of all the kids. But my dad, he had discovered his love of classical music because one of the priests who taught him had taken a load of boys from the school to a classical concert in Belfast. And my dad, who they had no music in their home really whatsoever, and he fell completely in love with it. And it was a sort of transformative thing, really, that, you know, this kind of working class lad from Belfast suddenly had this sort of taste in music that nobody else shared.
You know, it seemed to be something that was a lot more prevalent sort of in the first half of the 20th century, that idea of sort of it not feeling weird or shameful for a working class person to go and see classical music. And there was, you know, there were town halls and local music halls and concert halls, and they would put on concerts, and it was just something that people did.
Yeah, and it wasn't that sort of... There's that weird snobbery, you know, kind of Daily Mail style sort of, oh, it's an elitist pursuit.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I certainly never felt like, oh, this isn't for the likes of me. I think in a way that maybe I sort of felt a little bit sort of weird about... Because when I got to university, sort of liking classical music was not particularly cool. And the kind of people who like classical music were either sort of actual posh people or people who were sort of affecting to be posh and would wear smoking jackets and smoke pipes. And
types.
Yes, exactly, cosplaying
as
toffs, really. And so I felt a little bit kind of embarrassed about it. But I think, yeah, my dad certainly never did. And he absolutely loved... singing. It could not sing to save his life, but he loved to sing, and I have inherited that as well. I love a karaoke. I love to just express myself. And so he absolutely inculcated a love of classical music in me from a very early age. Particularly opera was his thing.
So the catchphrase, your tiny hand is frozen, came first, and then you found out where it came from.
Yes.
Which was the Puccini opera, La Bohème.
Yes.
Now, I came to that music the other way round, which was hearing the music first and only going to see the opera much later and finding out what they're actually singing about. And I was really surprised in La Bohème that it's about a bunch of students living in a grotty flat and they're all talking about not having enough money to pay for the gas meter type of thing. And you know, the songs, which are these beautiful arias, are often about quite mundane things.
Yes. Because, I mean, I quite liked... We used to go and see a lot of filmed opera at the Fairfield Halls in Croydon.
Mm.
And I, you know, as a kid, I couldn't really relate to some of the more sort of melodramatic people dying and, you know, grand passion and romance. But I quite like La Bohème. I like La Bohème and I think kind of Italian opera really is more my thing.
Yeah, you know, if anyone asks me what opera should I go and see, I said, you know, start with some Verdi or Puccini or something like that. I remember actually in the 80s when I was working as a painter and decorator with a group of friends, we were sort of doing up places, and I was also starting to work with Harry Enfield at the time. We were writing loads of money. And we, after work one day, we all went in our work clothes to the piazza at Covent Garden because they were live streaming, I suppose you would call it these days, La Boheme from the Royal Opera House with Domingo singing. And it was great down there in the piazza. But we then worked that up into a Loads of Money sketch, which was about him and his mates going to the opera, singing Domingo, Domingo, Domingo. Because, you know, we were posh builders going to the opera.
Yeah. Well, Pavarotti was such a fixture. Again, as a kid, there was more kind of awareness of classical music on telly and stuff. In that, I remember thinking, oh, Pavarotti is that sort of funny fat man, because there were so many sketches and, you know.
Yeah, well, I suppose it was the Telly 90 that really made those guys famous. But, and opera was everywhere. And, you know, what that proved is that that music and those arias are incredibly accessible and people can get into them. So the idea that you have to get a degree in cleverness in order to listen to this music is nonsense. So you listen to a lot of music courtesy of your father, with your father?
Yeah, because he was into two things, classical music and really extraordinarily easy listening, James Last and... Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass was the soundtrack to my childhood.
Eddie Mantovani?
Yeah, Mantovani. Richard Clayderman, who was sort of that kind of bridge between classical... Because there was also stuff like... Do you remember Classical Gas?
Yes.
And the London Philharmonic had a couple of pop hits, didn't they, as well?
Yeah, well, you know...
Hooked on classics.
Yeah,
and that.
Well, that sort of still goes on, where they do, the Royal Philharmonic do a lot of sort of... things at the Albert Hall where they'll do orchestral versions of Queen songs and things like that.
CBeebies great, actually, because they always do little proms for kids and slip some stuff in.
Yeah, no, there's some great, great stuff on at the proms. So the next question I always ask is, what is your favourite piece of classical music? Now, classical music is a sort of broad church, particularly here on Scala. So it's sort of anything that is orchestral or film music or whatever. And you've gone for, and you did question it. You said, is this a bit naff?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's naff. I think it's gorgeous, obviously. And I could listen to it from here till the end of time. But it felt to me like I'm coming on Scala Radio. I should be picking something fancy, and I wasn't sure if this was fancy enough.
Not fancy enough for Scala.
So no. I apologise to your listeners if this
Scala
is not
Radio.
Fancy
It's not Radio 3. Certainly wouldn't be fancy enough for Radio 3. No, well, just so the audience know what we're talking about, it is the theme from Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence by Ryuichi Sakamoto. Was it an 80s film?
I think it probably was, yeah.
And are you a big fan of the film as well?
I've never seen the film.
Right, okay, so this is my guest, Lucy Porter, who has chosen a piece of music from a film that she's never seen as her favourite piece of music. I do that a lot. There's a lot of film music I listen to that are not from films I've never seen.
Yeah.
I have seen Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. I think I went to see it when it came out. And like all David Bowie films, apart from The Man Who Fell to Earth, it's a bit rubbish.
Yeah.
David Bowie being in a film is kind of a sign like, maybe I won't go and see that one.
What was the one, though? Is it The Dark Crystal? Or there's one of those sort of fantasy ones?
Labyrinth,
I think. That's it, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, he's really cheesy in it.
Yeah. Well, I didn't like David Bowie because I was exposed to him as an actor, and then sort of that weird period where it was like a little drummer boy, and there was just sort of something, a whiff of novelty about him, and I didn't know the amazing stuff that he had done and was yet to do. So, yeah, I thought he was a bit, well, naff.
Well, he did go a bit adrift in the 80s. He sort of lost his mojo of having been absolutely finger on the pulse, leading the pack.
I tell you what it was. It was Dancing in the Streets with Mick Jagger. That was the thing that made me, because being young and awful, I was like, oh, look at those two old men dancing around in big shirts, aren't they? And, you know, they're probably about the age that I am now. They're probably younger than I am now.
Yes, I know. That's the scary thing.
But, yeah, I thought, God, what are they doing still cavorting like that at their age?
And who would have thought that Mick Jagger would... would be at it still 30, 40 years later.
I know, I'm much too old to be his latest wife. You know, I mean, that ship has sailed for me, sadly. But then I did rediscover Bowie and I was like, he's amazing. Yeah. And also Ryuichi Sakamoto, I then kind of looked into a little bit of his back catalogue and an amazing kind of range of talents, and he basically reinvented electronic dance music, or invented electronic dance music largely. And then he's got this lovely, there's like a sort of easy listening-y type album. I think it's called Smoochie or something. Yeah, it's really, my dad would have loved that as well.
I must check it out. It sounds great.
Yeah, it is.
Are there any other film soundtracks you listen to, films that you either hate or have never seen?
Well, mostly the soundtracks that I like are for films that I do love.
The Piano. Have you seen The Piano?
Yes, I have seen The Piano.
I didn't love that film, actually. You didn't?
I like the soundtrack more than I like the movie.
You're supposed to love it. You're a woman.
Is it a woman's? Is it like Bridges of Madison County? Only women are allowed to watch it.
I think so. But I do love the music because I'm a huge fan of Michael Nyman.
Yes.
But no, one day I will sit down and watch the film.
Well, Peter Greenaway films always had those kind of amazing. Was it Michael Nyman or Philip Glass?
No, that was Michael Nyman. Yes.
Yeah, but I never really got on with, you know, The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. I was like, oh, it's long title.
I liked that one.
No, not for me.
Great music.
It's probably for men. That's probably what it is. It's one of those men's films that I've heard so much about.
Charlie Higson and Friends on Scala Radio.
You're listening to me, Charlie Higson, wibbling on here on Scala Radio with my lovely guest and friend, Lucy Porter. So, Lucy, people use music in a lot of different ways. And particularly these days, I think they use it to relax, to de-stress. And that's often classical music is recommended for that. There's endless playlists on Spotify of relaxing piano music.
There is Claire de Lune on repeat, basically.
Yes.
Well, I do use music to relax my fevered brain and also to calm the children down. That's, you know how they play classical music at tube stations in particularly challenging areas of
London.
And
at shopping malls when they're trying to drive all the teenagers out.
Yes, it's like high-pitched noises. It's something that they think will repel teenagers. But my kids actually really like it. And I have always, my whole life, had terrible trouble sleeping and terrible trouble switching off. And I, like so many of my comedy colleagues, have been diagnosed with ADHD in adulthood.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's a big thing that actually, you know, your brain is kind of so noisy that you need something.
But that probably really helps for a stand-up, to be able to stand there and just keep thinking fast and coming out with stuff.
Yeah, and also, yeah, you do have about 15 different thoughts, so you can just pick the one that appeals to you. And see, now I look back and I think my dad, clearly, you know, because it's a genetic thing apparently, but he clearly had ADHD and slightly terrifyingly because he was a pharmacist, and you know, it's a job where you'd think attention to detail is fairly necessary.
That sounds like a fast show sketch or a League of Gentlemen, the ADHD pharmacist.
Just slinging out any old pills. Just take it, get out of the
This
way.
One's good, or you could try this one.
Well, in fact, you know what, because he recounted to me this incredible story about inhalers. They used to have these basically sort of amphetamine inhalers that they'd give people for colds and things. And he'd left one on a heater.
It was Benzedrine, I think.
That's what it is, yes. And he'd left it on a heater. And so it all sort of kind of gassed up. And he took a hit on this and he went absolutely nuts for about 3 days. He was like, I couldn't sleep. But he said, but my mind felt really calm. So in a way, he was a pioneer of ADHD medication without knowing it. But yeah, so he used to always listen to music as he was drifting off to sleep, and I do the same now. So that would be, for me, sort of a nice piano piece or something.
Right. I particularly like in the summer to be out. If I'm on holiday, you can take your playlist with you on your phone and you can listen by the side of a pool with a cocktail.
Ooh,
I don't.
Vivaldi would go very nicely with a glass of something chilled by a pool, wouldn't it? A Frascati. I don't think I've had a Frascati for years. Is that still a thing?
I'm sure it is. We'll try and get you one in for the second half of the show.
I've not been on holiday for years, but yeah, if you could get me...
What do you mean you've not been on holiday for years?
Well, I just, you know, COVID and all COVID of that stuff, yeah, so I've not had the time. But, yeah, that's my dream, is to go to Italy.
And it's not quite the same when you've got younger children.
No, exactly. I want to get to an age where they can either sort of come and enjoy it or not come.
You want to get to the age where they will mix the cocktails and bring them to you.
Yes, that's, and then drive you back to wherever you're going. That's the ideal. But, yeah, I think they'd love to go to Italy. I think it'd be a nice little jaunt.
So, Lucy, let's just talk a little bit about your career, because you told me when we met that you started out at Granada TV as, you weren't a receptionist, were you?
Well, I was a kind of a runner, researcher. Sort of, yeah, general woman of all trades. Yes, and so this is where our lives and careers have kind of almost intersected, because I was employed by the brilliant, wonderful, amazing Carolina Hearn.
Yeah, who had started as a receptionist at Granada. And Granada being the amazing Manchester-based powerhouse for making so many fantastic programmes for ITV, and they sort of got absorbed into what became the conglomerate ITV.
Yes.
But back then was a fantastic... It must have been an amazing place to work.
Oh, it was TV in Manchester in the 1990s was just so much fun, because you had the BBC. So Caroline had actually started at the BBC on Oxford Road. And that was where they'd done, like, you know, loads of pop programmes from. And it was that had all that history. And then Granada was this big, huge building, sort of this tower that loomed over the whole of Manchester with this penthouse suite that was... looked like Joan Collins should be making a movie in it constantly.
And sadly, like everywhere else in Manchester, has been turned into a hotel now, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, because at one point in its heyday, it had the Granada Studios Tour, which was a theme park based around the Granada programming. So, you know, you could go into the Rover's Return, and then there was Shane Ritchie did some program about weddings, and there was some Shane Ritchie Love Me Do experience where you went on a love boat and stuff. So anyway, it was brilliant, such a great place to work.
And so when you say you worked for Caroline, what was she making at the time?
So when she did the Mrs. Merton show, I worked on the pilot of that. So she was amazingly kind and nurturing. And I think having kind of been a secretary herself and then kind of worked her way up, so she mentored me really. And so she let me come and book guests for the Mrs. Merton show, so which was an amazing job. And sometimes it was brilliant, like lovely Debbie McGee, who will forever be linked with the...
So did you book Paul and Debbie for that show then?
Yeah, well, in fact, because Debbie did it.
Oh, no, it was just Debbie, wasn't it?
No, but then she did it, and then Paul insisted. He phoned up and said, I want to come on the show, which no one ever did, because it was so hard to get people, because it was in Manchester, and, of course, most celebrities live in London or surrounding areas. And so it was like, oh, will you come up to Manchester and do this chat show? And it's a bit kind of weird, because it's a woman who's young, but she's pretending to be old, and loads of people were scared of it. The only people who would come on, actually, were people who either knew they had a good sense of humour, like Debbie McGee, or people who hadn't watched the tape that we'd sent them, like Jimmy Hill, who turned up and was absolutely baffled by the whole thing from start to finish. And Chris Eubank, which was one of the most terrifying nights of my life, because I'd booked Chris Eubank and I was looking after him, and he was not a happy bunny at all. And I honestly thought he was going to punch me. I was like, I will go down... like a sack of potatoes if he even breathes on me, let alone punches me. But yeah, so there were some exciting nights.
I mean, the guests on those things, I think the Jimmy Hill type ones are always the best, though. It's when they're kind of in on the joke that it doesn't quite
work.
Because I remember I would have been a similar time working with Vic Rees and Bob Mortimer in the early days of Shooting Stars. And again on that, you know, the guests like Larry Hagman, who would, you know, they'd come over from America and their publicist, because publicists are always desperate to say, look, I've got you on 6 different shows. So one of them's called Shooting Stars. It's easy. You just turn up and have fun. And yeah, they're utterly bewildered. always the most fun.
He was always, I always thought he looked like a good laugh though, Larry Hagman.
Yeah, he was. He had a good
Because in fact, on the Mrs. Merton show in Las Vegas, we had Bobby Ewing, Patrick Duffy, and he was brilliant. He was such a lovely man. And I have this lovely image of JR and Bobby on the set of Dallas just having a brilliant time and being best mates and being amazing.
Well, it was great for Caroline, because she would she would get on people that she liked.
Yeah, and the whole audience was her friends and family. Yeah. And it was because at Granada at that time, people were so mean to the audiences. Like, it was a really horrible culture in television where it was like, oh, God, the studio audience, they're such a pain, and we have to give them water and sit them down, you know, how inconvenient. And she, kind of being a lovely person, went, you know what, no, that's all wrong. What I want is for the audience to be part of the show. And I mean, that's another of the things that made it the success it was.
So having worked with Caroline Ahern on Mrs. Merton, you sort of moved up in the world there?
Well, I was so bad at being a TV researcher because I'm terrible at admin. And so Caroline encouraged me into the world of stand-up. And
that's quite a leap from researcher to stand-up.
Yeah, it is, because I was never, like, I wasn't an outgoing person. I'd never done any drama or anything like that. And I was terrified. I started doing stand-up really because I wanted to write. And that seemed like the easiest way to sort of do some writing and get it noticed.
Yeah.
So I didn't really have ambitions to be
Did you know any other stand-ups at the time?
Yeah, there was an amazing comedy scene in Manchester. So,
right.
Like, Caroline and John Thompson, Steve Coogan and Henry Normal were the older generation. But then coming through, there were people like Chris Addison, Dave Gorman, Peter Kay sort of burst onto the scene while I was there, Johnny Vegas, John Bishop.
Not a lot of women in that list.
No, there were very few of us, which, I mean, in some ways was an advantage because it meant that you would get booked sort of
And then you had your
quickly.
Pick of any... Any stand-up?
Yes. Well, I mean, let's not go into that. But, there was... it was a really, a very incestuous scene in so many ways.
But you must like comics because you married one.
Yes, I did. I did. Eventually, I found the funniest one and thought, I'll marry that one. So, Justin Edwards, who is... I mean, he's more of a character comedian than a stand-up.
Yes. Comedian. Well, we'll come back to that in a minute. But I quite impressed myself there that I've engineered a link into this next piece of music.
Well done,
which
seamless.
Which is the piece of music that you had played at your wedding.
Yes.
Played live?
A recording as I walked down the aisle. So, you know, you always think, I hated organising the wedding, hated it, never really wanted to get married, but we sort of just thought, we should. And I kind of, my mum and dad were very keen for...
So you walked down the aisle with your father?
Yes, and he'd been really ill. My dad, bless him, had terrible health in the last few years of his life. And so he'd had the last rites about three times, and then he sort of rallied. And then in one of these windows, I got married.
The wonderful Justin Edwards.
The very tall Justin Edwards. It was
physical comedy.
Yeah. He's 6'5" and I'm 4'11", so it looked... The whole thing was ridiculous. It looked like a circus. But
you weren't able to wear, like, stilts under your wedding dress or anything.
I did have to stand on a box.
You did have to stand on a box.
Which, in hindsight, I'm like, that was ridiculous. So, yeah, we've got... Our wedding photos are brilliant. The photographer was amazing, but he's a war photographer primarily, which is kind of appropriate for our relationship. And so they all look slightly harrowing in different ways, and especially the ones of our families together, because his family were all massive and then we're all these sort of tiny little misshapen Celts. It's just, yeah, it does look insane, but it was a lovely day, and it was really nice that my dad got to be there.
Yeah, and how has it been being married to someone in the same industry?
Well, we're not in direct competition for parts because obviously he plays...
Well, these days with gender fluid casting.
Yes, but if they've got a costume that fits him, that's how they do it, isn't it? They go, right, we've got this costume, who's going to fit it? I presume wardrobe dictate the casting process. But he does very glamorous things, so he goes off and does movies, and during COVID, he went off to film Death in Paradise, and I have never hated a human being more.
So he just deserted the whole thing. Family.
I was at home homeschooling the two children with very little success because...
Well, he had to keep the money coming in.
Well, he did.
That's what us men do.
Absolutely. He was breadwinning for us and sending me pictures of him on a beach with a cocktail. And
for those of you who can't picture Justin Edwards, you should look him up because he is a fabulous character actor. And I love character actors. You know, I grew up in the era of... watching all those black and white films on TV with the likes of John Le Mesurier and Sid James and Alistair Sim and Irene Handel.
Well, in fact, Justin and his friend Miles Jupp are currently in a stage adaptation of The Lavender Hill Mob.
Oh, excellent.
So he's basically being Stanley Holloway.
He's channeling all those great characters.
Yes.
And, you know, he's in so many things when you look into it, isn't he, in Justin?
Yeah. It's the way to be, just always be working and, you know, never be hot, always be warm, as somebody once said. And I've taken that. I've always been tepid, and I intend to continue to be so.
So my friend Lucy Porter played a piece of music that had emotional significance for her and tied her in back into memories of her father. I got into classical music when I was a boy at the same time as my father, who hadn't been into it, but he started getting into it. And he used to drive me into school in the mornings on his way to commute up to London. We lived down in Sevenoaks. And we would always listen to Radio 3 on the way in. And it was a sort of Radio 3 equivalent of the sort of drive time stuff. So it was a lot of big banging tunes.
The monsters of classical.
Yes. And I do very much remember a proper earworm, which is Handel's Arrival of the Queen of Sheba, Let's Rock.
Oh, that is a banger.
Charlie Higson and Friends on Scala Radio.
The Charlie Higson and Friends podcasts were originally broadcast on Scala Radio, a radio station that celebrates classical music in all its shapes and sizes. Why not join me, Charles Nove, for breakfast weekday mornings between 7 and 10? It would be wonderful to have you. Scala Radio broadcasts across the UK on DAB Digital Radio, on your smart speaker, the Scala Radio app, and online at scalaradio.co.uk.